This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Your child has a right to a free and equal education in North Carolina. Every child in the state does, in fact, have access to free schooling, but equality has been elusive. There is ample evidence to show that those with privilege tend to excel, while poor, minorities, and other disadvantaged people can fall behind. This week, the nonprofit news organization EdNC is releasing a four-part film series called Equity Meets Education. It focuses on racial equity in North Carolina schools, and joining us now is EdNC reporter Liz Bell, who produced the series. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. Tell us why you did this and focused on equity in North Carolina.
So when it comes to educational issues, racial equity is really something that touches every part of the education landscape. If we're looking at a classroom individual kind of level, race shows up in academic and discipline data. Black students in North Carolina are more likely to be suspended from school than their white peers and have worse academic outcomes than their white peers when it comes to cohort graduation rates, EOG test scores, and other measures. If we zoom out, it's racial equity is a systemic issue. In the educational system, an example of that is there's this rapidly diversifying student population, and the teacher workforce hasn't yet met that diversity. If we zoom out even further outside of the educational sphere, racial equity touches really every institution that impacts individuals. So it's a pervasive issue, and these specific men's stories are really powerful and insightful in how we move forward and get better.
Tell us about the men you chose to profile in this series and why you chose them.
Yes. So there's Toussaint Romain, a public defender in Charlotte, Jason Terrell, the executive director of Profound Gentlemen, which is working to support male educators of color, James Ford, principal at let me make sure I get this right.
James Ford was Teacher of the Year.
Yeah, was Teacher of the Year.
And now is a consultant, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
Donnell Cannon.
And Donnell Cannon, principal of North Edgecombe High School. All of these
it's a great
men
film.
Are
that's why I know
super
it.
Inspiring.
Inside and out.
Right. Super inspiring people in their stories, in their individual stories, and in their work around shaping the conversation of equity in schools. And we wanted some diversity geographically. There's a lot of different environments and cultures across North Carolina, depending where you are. So Donnell has an important rural perspective. Toussaint is kind of focused on an urban perspective in Charlotte. James gives us that statewide point of view. And Jason is working on some of these issues on a nationwide scale.
Well, we have three of those people you've profiled with us on the show today. The fourth is the principal at Edgecombe High School, North Edgecombe High School, Donnell Cannon. And here's what he says. He defines for us education equity.
My definition of equity is, like, equity is the process of, like, how we ensure that every kid has access to high-quality education. So, for an example, in a student school that I currently serve, in the county I currently serve, there's a huge disparity between, like, what access to resource a kid may have in Chapel Hill, like Raleigh area, may have compared to some of the deeper rural communities.
That's Donnell Cannon, who's the principal of North Edgecombe High School. He is one of the featured educators in a new film series, Equity Meets Education, from EdNC. And I'm here with EdNC reporter and series producer Liz Bell. And joining us now are three of the other leaders who are profiled in this film series. James Ford, the 2014 North Carolina Teacher of the Year. He's now a consultant with Filling the Gap Educational Consultants. James, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Frank.
Jason Terrell is co-founder and executive director of Profound Gentlemen, an organization working to build a community for male educators of color. Hello, Jason.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. And Toussaint Romain is an assistant public defender in Charlotte and an adjunct professor at UNC Charlotte. Toussaint, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Humbled to be here with these guys.
A pleasure to have you, and all three of you are sitting together in the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. James, let me start with you. You've been both a teacher and you've served on the governor's committee to advise educators. How would you define equity in education?
Yeah, so I think that equity deals with equality of opportunity. And the interesting thing about that is that, you know, our state constitution actually mentions that as such. that the state is to provide, you know, equal access to opportunity. And so what ends up happening is we try to do a one size fit all type of deal, and people are, you know, unequally situated. And so when you recognize it due to race, we recognize it due to poverty and a host of other factors that kids don't have the same starting place, you have to take that into account if you really want to equalize opportunity for children. And, you know, honestly, my first time ever going to a state board of education meeting, it really was brought to the light because the co-chair, a friend of mine, Buddy Collins, approached me and he said, you know, James, I want to know during your time here, what can we do to improve outcomes for boys of color in particular? And his basic premise was that if we can, you know, improve the outcomes for the most vulnerable populations, then the rest of the groups ultimately would benefit from that. And whether he knew it or not, he was really communicating the spirit of what equity is.
And that spirit and certainly the goal has been an elusive one. Jason, your goal has been to mentor teachers of color because the lack of representation in the classroom has been cited as one of the problems in keeping this this inequality in place. And you do that so minority children can see and are taught by people like them. Tell us more about the importance of that and maybe give us a sense of how unbalanced things are in the classroom right now.
That sounds good. So just looking at a national perspective, so it's actually less than 2% of all your teachers in public schools are men of color. Even though like the student diversity population is growing, like I think by 2020 we'll be a predominantly minority district in a lot of our major cities. However, your teachers don't reflect that. It's actually an interesting study done by Johns Hopkins University. I'm actually looking at North Carolina teachers, and that showed that when a male of color, a young male of color, has a black male teacher, they increase their graduation rates by 33% to 40%. I'm just one black male teacher throughout their K-12 experience. So, you know, our goal is to ensure that these young men not only have the opportunity to see these, you know, men who reflect their background, who identify with them, who they can kind of share similar experiences with, but also we want to train these men to have that additional impact on these students so that graduation rate can increase.
What do you think is holding the numbers down now? Why do we have this inequality in the classroom?
Oh, man, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, this is the problem with men of color entering to the space is very similar to a lot of teachers. Most of your school districts start off with a teacher deficit every single year, teacher shortage. And the primary reasons are kind of the school culture and climate is not conducive for a lot of these men. We're talking about pay, talking about the lack of professional development that they offer, the opportunities to really navigate the career ladder. So there's a lot of barriers in place that it's not really making the profession valuable, but the most important thing is we like to use this model in our organization is you can't be what you can't see. So oftentimes, you know, it's hard to aspire to be something that you never really had before. So that really also causes that, you know, the lack of diversity in the profession.
Toussaint, let's talk about this from a legal standpoint. It's the North Carolina state constitution does guarantee equal opportunity, and that was found to be breached in a very, very important legal case, Leandro versus the state, that revealed that poor rural counties are not getting the same basic sound education. Tell us more about that case and where it is today.
Yeah, so great question. I wasn't familiarized. I didn't look up that case as far as how its application has been currently. Yeah. I can tell you, though, that as far as how schools have interpreted that and how the law has been passed down to those who implement policies that are supposed to support the law, I think would be akin to how we responded to the Brown versus Board of Education with all deliberate speed. You know, we're still struggling. We still have not developed the type of school system that really accomplishes the needs of our students or meets the needs of our students. Listen, we're not talking about creating something different and something that's that provides more for children of color. We're talking about equity, which is basic needs, right? We're talking about giving them the same thing that other schools have, and we're not seeing that. And, you know, fortunately, with the great work that James and Jason are doing, collectively, they'll be able to empower more individuals to get into the classroom. But for what we see now, it's really the result and the product of years of neglect, years of trouble. And unfortunately, those that fail from the school system as we currently have it, become my clients in the courtroom.
Well, let's talk about what we see now. James Ford, former North Carolina Teacher of the Year. Let's talk about the numbers. The nation's report card compared poor white students to middle class. So poor white students compared to middle class black students. What are the findings there and what are the significance of those findings?
We're looking at fourth grade math scores on the NAEP in 2015. There's a 1-point difference. That's right. 1-point difference between the achievement of economically disadvantaged white students and working in middle class black students. And the reason why that's particularly staggering to me is because so often when we talk about racial equity, there's this tendency to say, well, it's not race. It's not a race thing. Why are we talking about race? It's poverty. And we tend to conflate the two. The reason why that stat stands out is because it shows that even beyond poverty, and poverty is an issue, let's be clear, young people are saddled with the baggage of lack. But even amongst those who lack, there's a marked difference between their academic performance. And you look at something as critical as mathematics scores in fourth grade, that kind of gives you an idea of what the path is for prosperity if there isn't some major intervention that takes into account the way that race impacts the outcomes of young people.
What is the way in which race impacts the outcome? If middle class black students are doing about as well as poor white students, what is the racial component? How does that enact itself in the classroom to cause a disadvantage for students of color?
So the short answer is a multitude of ways, Frank. It's not one particular thing. The racial gap is made up of a lot of different things. Naturally, I think that Toussaint mentioned implicit bias. That's one thing. But the other thing is, frankly, just, I hate to lay this at the feet of teachers because, you know, we get blamed for everything as it is. But teachers just aren't adequately prepared to deal with the diverse cultures that show up in the classroom. Race is not merely color of skin. It is a life experience. It is a cultural outlook. And when you are in a class with people who come from radically different backgrounds, they have different ways of knowing, different ways of acquiring knowledge, different skill sets that aren't always identified and recognized or empowered. And oftentimes they're seen through a deficit lens of not having everything down to, as Jason mentioned, the teachers that are in the classroom. That shows a marked difference in rates of suspension and rates of referral to academically intellectually gifted and obviously graduation. The list goes on. It's literally like a mile long when we talk about how race shows up. But I think the point is that the reason why we keep talking about it is because it's relevant. It's significant. And that's not just anecdotal. That's proven.
All right, Toussaint Romain, assistant public defender in Charlotte and also adjunct professor at UNC Charlotte. Let's talk a little bit about what happens when these disparities are allowed to play out. We've ticked them off briefly, but let's talk about the disparity and the misrepresentation of students of color in gifted and talented programs. There's plenty of research that shows how these mistakes are being made, and students are often sent to learning disabled classes when they should be in gifted and talented, work done right here at Duke University. Let's just take that marker for one and talk about what that means and how you would, at your end of the spectrum as a public defender, and people you see who come into contact with the criminal justice system who may have been mislabeled early on in their academic career.
Great question. And let me, if I can, be that lawyer and challenge maybe one word that you mentioned as you presented this question. And that's the word mistake, to mistake something. They're not mistakenly placed in these other classes. It's an intentional, deliberate act. These things are done based on our implicit bias, based on the way the system is designed. And you can see this across the board, across the state. Now, if it happened in one school and one kid was there, then we would maybe go back to the anecdote or maybe talk about, okay, that was a mistake. But when it's true across the board, across the state, in nearly every school that has this inequity or unequitable situation, we can't call that a mistake. That's intentional. So part two to this question is what I see quite often is that my clients have dropped out at 9th or 10th grade and then, you know, have presented this situation or life of crime or just presented in a situation of crime to how I'm appointed to represent them. But what I've asked our superintendent and Dr. Peter Gorman in particular when he was that superintendent, hey, man, why are these kids dropping out at 9th and 10th grade? What's going on? And his answer was at Toussaint, they're not able to pass English 1 or Math 1, which are base level classes. And that's primarily because the teachers aren't providing that for them, and we're not following up. But then he said something even more intriguing. He said, but Toussaint, the reality is we failed them not in 9th or 10th grade. We failed them in the 3rd grade, because that's where we determine where schools or prisons are built. And the end of EOGs or whatever the exam is that's provided, the number of failures that those number of students that fail that exam is how we determine how many prison beds to actually make.
But I have to stop you right there. Do you mean that the actual correction system looks at third grade test results and says we need to make more beds because of the increase in the number of failures, if that's what they found?
Well, Frank, it's a little more indirect than I think your point might make it, but the number of beds, and this has been shown through research, the number of beds and the number of prison cells and jail cells and the breadth of a criminal justice system has correlation directly to the number of failures within the third grade. And so what Jason and James are both saying, and if I can, I like Liz's idea of zooming out, right? I'm the zoomed out guy. These gentlemen are in the classroom, and I applaud the work that they do. But if we can zoom out to just the criminal justice system, what we're talking about are not just inequities in school and having to prove those inequities in school, but those inequities exist in pre-development. It exists in housing situations. It exists in opportunities for job. It exists in opportunities in life. And so we're only talking about just this single shot of the schools and the school systems. But if we look around the nation, listen, it's evident about where the problems are. And when we don't provide opportunities for them to do better in life, then it's inevitable they'll become my clients, because the only other direction is not good.
Jason Terrell, educator and co-founder of Profound Gentlemen. Let me ask you what you do about this. I know that you're focusing on support for teachers of color, African-American men in particular, who can get into the classroom and teach. But this does sound like a serious problem of cultural competence. If we have 80 or 90% white teachers in the classroom today, and we find that black students are being assigned to the wrong classes, they are not being held to high enough expectations, and then we didn't even mention discipline, the disproportionate discipline that's handed out to African-American men for the same offense. So first-time cell phone users far disproportionately suspended if you're black than if you're white in Wake County, for instance. So all of those metrics, right, indicate perhaps a lack of cultural competence. People don't quite understand what's going on. Is there a way in which you can train those in the classroom now to address these disparities before you achieve your goals of putting more black men in the classroom?
Yeah, so two parts to that question. So the first thing that I guess when we think about cultural competence is from an individual, a teacher to student level, it's from a principal to teacher level, it's a systemic issue. And that's something that we try to address as much as possible. So part of our model is professional development for schools and school districts. We had one for CMS, Charlotte-Mecklenburg School System, this summer. We trained the principals on hiring practices. And what does it look like to hire diverse leaders in your school? What does it look like to onboard diverse leaders in your school? What does it look like to teach your teachers, critical cultural competency so they can deal with their students and deal with them in an academic level, on a behavioral level, and all facets of that. So the second thing is to really think about the work that we do. So the work that we do is really not centered on recruiting, because the analogy I like to give is, imagine you have a leaky pail. So the pail has a hole in it. No matter how much teachers you put into this pail, they will always continue to flood out because you have to plug that hole. So our goal is really retention. Our goal is keeping these high quality teachers in the classroom year after year. So that when the profession becomes an enticing profession for young educators who are coming into the system. So it's twofold for that.
All right. Well, I'm going to continue this conversation in a moment. I'm talking to Jason Terrell, the founder of Profound Gentlemen, co-founder and executive director of Profound Gentlemen, which is an organization geared toward bringing more men of color into teaching. Toussaint Romain is an assistant public defender in Charlotte. James Ford, the 2014 North Carolina Teacher of the Year and an educational consultant. And Liz Bell, a reporter for EdNC, who produced a film series called Equity Meets Education. We'll talk more about the film, and we'll talk with these gentlemen about education in North Carolina when our conversation on the state of things continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In celebration of the National Day of Racial Healing, EdNC is releasing a four-part film series called Equity Meets Education. EdNC reporter Liz Bell is with us. She produced the series. Also with us from partner station WFAE in Charlotte are three of the education leaders who are featured in the films. James Ford is an award-winning educator and a consultant at Filling the Gap Educational Consultants. Jason Terrell is co-founder and executive director of Profound Gentlemen, an organization geared toward bringing more men of color into teaching. And Toussaint Romain is an assistant public defender in Charlotte and now an adjunct professor at UNC Charlotte. James, let's start. We've been talking in terms mostly black and white. Do Hispanics factor into this discussion and other racial minorities, Native Americans?
So let me pause there by saying I'm so happy you asked that question, because one thing we have to stop doing is framing conversations about race according to the racial binary. I think the experience of race relations in America has always been black and white. But truthfully, I mean, we're a technicolor society now, right? We're multiracial. And the answer is absolutely for not just Latino and Latina students, but for Native American students. People forget that North Carolina has 9 recognized Native American tribes who also experience these disparate outcomes. So for, you know, African-American students, you know, we're suspended at about 4 times the rate of our white counterparts. For Native American students, it's about 3.5, if you can imagine that, Frank, even though they're 1.3% of the overall school enrollment. For Latinx students, we know that, you know, that's a population that's increased almost 400% over the past 20 years in North Carolina. We're a hypergrowth area when it comes to that. And even Asian groups who we tend to group all together, when you really break out such an expansive term, Asian, what you find, some of the research has found, is that for South Asians, it's a different experience than for folks from more Far East Asian countries. So the answer is yes. We have to continue, when we talk about racial equity, to look at the whole panorama for mixed race students, et cetera.
Jason, let's talk more about because of the influx in this state of people from Latin American countries, the Hispanic students that have increased in number in our state. How about an increase in educators? Have we seen a proportionate rise in their numbers as well?
Oh, no, not at all. And that's something that was really core to our work. When we initially started Profound Gentlemen, we wanted to solely focus on black male educators. But I've actually shifted that language. I'm going to focus on male educators of color.
That's good.
Because we believe and we know that our Latino educators, men of color, are really impacting kids. I'm in the classroom that, you know, a lot of our black, you know, men of color, you know, we don't have those experiences that we can't reach as effectively. So, yeah, it's critical, but no, not yet.
Toussaint Romain, last year you made national headlines. People may recognize your name because you made headlines during the protest in Charlotte. I want to listen to a clip of you live from the protest with CNN.
You were taking on tear gas as we were. What is it that made you want to stand there in front of, you know, these protesters and between them and police and tell them to calm down? What is it that made you come out here?
We can't lose any more lives, man. I'm a public defender. I can't represent any more people. We don't need more people to go to die. No more people being arrested.
There we go. Toussaint Romain, that was speaking with CNN Live at the protest in Charlotte last year. I want to ask you, Toussaint, if you think there is any, I mean, you corrected me, and rightly so, by saying, well, this is not necessarily a mistake. We can't see a system with this kind of disparity that has gone on this long and continue to call it an error. There must be something more intentional involved here. Is there intentional resistance, do you think, to making the kinds of changes and reforms that you put your finger on?
Yeah, I think the resistance is something that I'm not clear enough to really articulate at the moment. But what I've learned is that there, at least in criminal justice, there is a consensus model, meaning everyone kind of agrees that things are the way they are. And we all agree to that. But then there's also simultaneously this conflict model, to where there are people of our community that feel like, you know what, it doesn't work for us that way. And so what I would say is I think the majority of people, in particular white people, would say, well, no, the kids in school are misbehaving and these kids in school are doing this to themselves. It's their behavior that's causing these issues. It's their decision to do this. And then they can pinpoint a particular behavior that supports that thought and that position. And I think what James, Jason, and I, and what I believe Danielle and Liz are highlighting is that, okay, there may be a particular pinpointed behavior, but the truth is there is a broader systemic issue that's going on. So there are, Frank, if I could ask you, there are a lot of things I could ask, you know, and for your listeners, who here has ever committed a crime, right? All of our hands would go up. The reality is, which one of us is more likely to be focused and to be targeted by the police for that crime? And which one of us would get treatment, let's say if it was an opium or heroin, which one of our listeners are more likely to receive treatment for that addiction as opposed to, you know, incarceration for that crime? You know, and what I'm talking about in particular is how there is the disparate treatment between white folks who use heroin and then black folks who use crack cocaine.
And of course, that's at the end
I'm
of the system.
I'm getting off topic a little bit.
No, but I mean, this is something that where the in some ways the fix is in third grade, and it's much less obvious than when you finally make contact with the criminal justice system. At which point, once there's a felony, it becomes pretty tough to dig yourself out.
It's game over.
But if things
are
happening in third grade that don't look like a felony, but that are actually channeling you in that direction, that's pretty subversive stuff.
Yeah, and I think James mentioned maybe off the air earlier, and I'd love for him to jump in at this, but we tend to over-penalize and over-punish and over-discipline children of color harsher than we do white students for the same exact crime or the same exact infraction.
Yep.
Because of, again, this implicit bias. And I think that hopefully answers the question that you're asking, and that's why we tend to see the resistance is, well, no, those kids do it and they deserve it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, well, not my kid or not our kids, because, you know, our kids, the only time they get in trouble is when they've actually done something, right? Black kids don't have to really do things, but still receive harsher treatments. And that cognitive dissonance doesn't make sense because many folks want to blame the behavior instead of recognizing the systemic disparity.
Tell us more about that, James. In terms of discipline, what are some of the disparities that you've seen?
Yeah, so there's some researchers, one of whom is Russell Skiba from out of University of Indiana, this is his area of specialty. And what he realizes is that there are two major buckets that offenses at school fall into. Objective offenses, these are things that are hardline things that have policy prescriptions. So we're talking about vandalism, assault of staff, bringing a weapon to school, et cetera, right? There's no gray area there. And then there are subjective offenses. And these are things like disrespect, insubordination, aggressive behavior. And in his research, and even when we look at North Carolina data, the disparities are really more profound between races in the subjective areas. Meaning somebody's making an internal calculation to say that I'm going to punish this student harsher for that. There's another study called Two Strikes, which takes the discipline profiles of two students, right? They're identical. And it has one name that's a typical, quote unquote, white name. And it has another same profile and it puts it in front of teachers. And it's a stereotypical black name like Deshaun or something. And they notice that after the second offense that they begin punishing the black students harsher. It's called a black escalation effect. And every subsequent offense becomes even more and more punitive. I think what Toussaint is saying is that a study released like 2 weeks ago said that in the criminal justice system, African-American men are punished more harshly for the same crime. So what we're saying is these are different ends of the same continuum. The same system is at play. It just starts when you're in education. And unfortunately, you can see it even when you become adults and in the criminal justice system.
Is what you're describing here, this kind of implicit bias, let's call it implicit bias for the moment and assume that the teacher has the best intentions just for the moment. Is this anything that training can fix if you haven't come, again, with an explicit bias, if you haven't come with the sole purpose of causing this kind of pain? Is this something that training can actually have an impact on?
Can I jump in real quickly? So I worked with CMS, and we worked. There was these 22 task force. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, and the superintendent, Dr. Heath Morrison, at the time, commissioned a few task force. One of those was a cultural competency task force, which I was on with some leaders here in town. And what we realized through that training and development, and then we hired a consultant to come in and do the work, was that if teachers become aware of this implicit bias, as well-meaning as they are, and I believe many of them are, but as they become aware of this implicit bias, it allows them the opportunity to arrest that development or to stop themselves from behaving in a way that's directly related to those thoughts. So in essence, if a teacher is aware that they will tend to over-penalize or over-punish a student of color for an infraction that a white student could commit, then that student when that teacher says, put away your phone, and the eyes are rolled, and the teacher feels disrespected, that teacher can become aware of, all right, I'm aware of what's happening here. I'm aware that I was getting ready to suspend this student, but let me take a step back and now apply the type of response that I would for a white student whose parents are going to come to school and ask why their child got suspended for rolling the eyes. Like, I don't have an answer for that. So let me treat this black student who did that the same as I would a white student. And that kind of awareness is really the only way to help change the game as it relates to implicit bias.
James, as someone who spent a lot of time in the classroom, I guess you might say that this has to start at the top, that the building is really, the culture of the building comes from the principal. So they need to be aware as well.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that same thing. I think Toussaint laid that out beautifully as it pertains to teachers. But the truth of the matter is, most of the time, it's not teachers who suspend, right? It's the administrative staff who makes that calculation. And again, you know, I don't think it's about blame, right? I think everybody's at fault, but nobody's to blame, right? We all have a part in this system. But so say that it's, you know, the implicit biases or what have you aren't necessarily caught by a self-aware teacher. There are procedural things that could be done. Things look at processes. We're talking about data strategies where you can quarterly break out your discipline data, not just your discipline data, but your enrollment data and everything else to see how race is showing up. And you can hold yourself accountable for interrogating those things. Right. So but it's incumbent upon the school leader, somebody there who is race conscious enough to say, this is something that, you know, despite our best efforts, despite, you know, that we experience ourselves as good people, because of the kids, right? Because we're talking about real human lives at stake, we're going to have to hold ourselves to a standard. And it can't just be a training. It can't just be a speaker. It needs to be something that's embedded the same way that we approach literacy, right? It needs to be in everything. And so those are some of the things that I think could go a long way.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we've seen this in police departments, too, who are grappling with some of the same problems at that end of the spectrum. Those police chiefs who have taken the statistics seriously and saying, look, I'm not sure what it is. I think I have great officers here, but these statistics bother me. I'm going to dig down and figure out what it is. I've seen great improvements in those police chiefs who have said, my guys are great, and frankly, I don't know what these statistics mean. I'm not going to burrow down, seem to have a repetition of the same problem. So it would be interesting to see if that correlates to classrooms as well. Liz Bell, let me ask you, the reporter for at EdNC, who put this series together, as you go across the country and talk about policy, both at the local level and the state level, is there a disparity, a kind of two different visions about precisely what the problem is before we even get to solutions? How are people talking about what these statistics mean and how to approach them from a policy level?
Well, I would say it really depends on the person and their own perspective of the world. I think something that each of these men kind of thread through this series and do a good job in explaining is the importance of recognizing our individual privileges, our individual parts in how we can use our platforms, our privileges to help those less privileged, less fortunate, have more of an equal shot at leading meaningful, successful lives.
But I guess that means you are hearing very different ways of how people hear this problem to begin with. And then, yes, how do you approach it after that? Tell us more about the series. What is it? How can we see it? How is it being distributed?
Yes. So the first video on Donnell Cannon, his story and his perspective, is live right now at EdNC.org. And the other three videos on these three leaders who are with us today on air are publishing the rest of this week. So come to EdNC.org, and there will be a link right on the main page to the videos.
Well, let me ask the three of you gentlemen in Charlotte, starting with you, Jason Terrell, what do you hope might come from these videos, and you know, what do you hope will be the outcome? Jason?
Yes, great question. Something I was thinking about, hopefully the two outcomes for me will be, one, awareness building, getting people aware that this problem won't exist, two, maybe what are some potential solutions to the problem. So that's kind of the first big thing. But the last, you know, the second thing is honestly policy implications. I think a lot of these things, especially around teacher quality, teacher diversity, could really be solved at the state level. But a lot of that has to come from, you know, advocacy on the ground. So ideally that awareness would build up some type of fervor where, you know, we hold our elected officials, we push for certain policies that make the profession a profession where we want to, you know, men of color, all teachers can come and thrive. So those are the two big things for me.
Toussaint Romain, what about you?
Well, Jason definitely stole my first answer, so it's all good, though. What I would say first and foremost is thanks to Liz and Ed, Education NC, for doing this work. I don't know that I've really have seen something like this where we're talking about, you know, four different folks right down that continuum, for me, of the school-to-prison pipeline. We tend to segment these conversations in ways where they're isolated, but I'm really grateful that we're having this conversation. And I think to Jason's first point, it's going to create awareness for many folks who don't see how those pieces of the puzzle connect. I think more importantly, I hope that this work will do two things. I hope it will improve the number of opportunities that James, Jason, and Donnell have to be in the classroom and to consult and to work to improve our educational system, and simultaneously, I hope that it will decrease the number of clients that I have.
James Ford, I've left you precious little time, but I wonder if you spent a lot of time in the classroom and heard a lot about reform over those years. Are you optimistic things can change?
Absolutely. I still hold out hope. It's the only thing that keeps me motivated. And, you know, one of my favorite leaders who we commemorated yesterday, I think, is a symbol of that. My hope is that we, in full transparency, I'm working, partnering with EdNC and NCCPPR, the Center for Public Policy Research, to accomplish three things. One is what this video does. It starts to collect research, anecdotal, narrative, qualitative, case studies on how race shows up. Two is start engaging around these things. How can we be reflective in our practice? And the third is the toughest one, which is implementation. How can we on the ground get this information to schools, to districts, and start finding ways to actually start changing outcomes for all students of color? And I'm committed.
James Ford, Jason Terrell, Toussaint Romain, thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Liz Bell, a reporter for EdNC and a producer of the film, which, if you want to find out more, you should go to our website, stateofthings.org, to find out more about the film and where you can see it. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.